Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two guests helping today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Stephanie Kuntz, who will tell us how the entire workforce has been feminized. And then Branko Milanovic will talk about the global distribution of income. My first guest is Stephanie Kuntz. She teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. The author of several important books, perhaps most famously, The Way We Never Were, American Families in the Nostalgia Trap. She had an article in the New York Times on January 11th on what a classically feminist agenda could do for men, the downwardly mobile gender. Here's Stephanie Kuntz to tell us more. Welcome, Stephanie. We've got Maria Shriver convening a celebrity cast to focus on women's needs at the moment. Do you think the timing is good on this?
Well, I do think that the timing is good, although my initial reaction to it was to kind of say, why are we doing so much about how women are doing it all and women are falling behind, when in fact the most dramatic losses are being experienced by men? And I think it's really important that we acknowledge that. I've been irritated by getting feminist announcements of how many women fell into poverty compared to last year, when actually there were more men in poverty. So there's been a back and forth on these things that we need to take more account of. But that was a kind of long-winded way of saying that the more I thought about it, the more I realized that this is a good time to solidarize ourselves with men and to recognize that a lot of the things that women need, which maybe 50 years ago would have been threatening to male privileges in the workplace, are exactly what most men need today.
Now, when you say this, I think some feminists get uncomfortable that you will be, by saying these things, you're minimizing the discrimination that women suffer, the glass ceiling, et cetera, et cetera. You're essentially betraying the movement by talking about men. How do you respond?
Well, I don't think that's true. I mean, first of all, let me say that I think we can work on many different levels, and I'm not opposed to helping women to lean in and step up. I think that is a matter of simple justice. But getting women to be one half of the top 1% or even one half of the top 10% doesn't solve the problems of most women. And therefore, I think it's very important to recognize the class issues here that are going on, that gender and class interact in very important ways that disadvantage women in many, many ways, but that also disadvantage men from a slightly different perspective and increasingly disadvantage men. So it seems to me that most feminists would welcome this, not because it's good news that men are falling behind. I don't think any of us wanted to catch up with men in our wages because men were losing ground, but because it's important to know that you have allies who have the same interests and issues. And I think that's the really important thing to get today, is that the issues of men and women, at least of the bottom 80% of men and women, are really converging.
This brutal economic cycle, we are supposedly like 3.5 years out of recession, but it certainly doesn't feel that way to most people. The recession itself was brutal. It was nicknamed the man session by some people. But what's happened to the genders in this brutal recession and weak recovery?
Well, it's been like a seesawing back and forth. You get some people saying, oh, it's been the end of men, because, in fact, men did lose 80% of the jobs in the early stages of the recession. But on the other hand, you have some people saying, well, see, you know, it's just coming back to women again, because in the aftermath of the recession with the cutbacks, it's women who were losing jobs. However, a new report out just this month shows that in December, women had regained 100% of the jobs lost and men only 75%. That doesn't mean that women are winning, though, because we're all regaining jobs that are worse than they were before the recession, and real wages, job security have been falling for more than three decades. It's not just the recession. So I think it's very important that we understand that this is not something that's just happening to men or just happening to women. Now, the Shriver Report focuses in on the fact that women are much more likely to live in extreme poverty than men because, of course, they tend to be the ones who end up bearing the responsibility for children that are either conceived out of wedlock or left in single-parent households after a divorce. But, you know, in some ways, that also reflects the problems that men face because low-income men, combined with the loss of jobs, the loss of real wages, the extraordinary rise in incarceration in black communities, low-income men are actually more disadvantaged in the marriage market than low-income women at this point in history.
What's been happening with the gender pay gap? Break it down. What's respectively happening with men and women?
The gender pay gap was closing very nicely in the very rapidly in the 80s and 90s, and then there came to be a stall in the mid-90s. Unfortunately, part of the pay gap closure was because of men's losses. About a quarter of the closure of the pay gap has been because men have been losing real wages. Until about 2000, women were gaining real wages at all income levels. That's because they started at such a much lower level, and it's also because, you know, 50 years ago we did, when the Civil Rights Act extended anti-discrimination laws to women, and it became no longer so easy to pay women blatantly discriminatory wages. So women's real wages that started from a much lower base have been catching slowly up. Another reason they've been catching up in general is because women have been getting more college degrees in recent years. And although at every educational level, women earn less on average than men with the same education, the fact that now women have more BAs means that in many metropolitan areas, women in their 20s who haven't started having kids yet earn more than their male counterparts because there are more educated women. But there's also a pay gap at the top. One of the interesting things, and the reasons that this is complex, is that the pay gap for really high-earning men and women is even higher than it is for low-earning men and women. On the other hand, the gap between high-wage workers, male or females, and low-wage workers is just extraordinarily high. It's the highest of all the OECD countries that have been studied. And it means that because women tend to concentrate more in low-wage occupations, that women are more hurt by this gap.
You ask in the piece why not focus on gender-neutral economic policies that would help everyone, especially at the bottom end. Why not?
In some ways, of course, we should be doing that. There's lots of gender-neutral policies. But unfortunately, a lot of things that people think of as gender-neutral were actually policies and work practices that were developed with the idea of a man as its normal or typical model in mind. For example, you know, economists talk about the disembodied worker. Well, Joan Acker pointed out some years ago that, no, the ideal worker, the idealized abstract worker on which both political and economic policies have been raised, was actually occupied a male body. He never got pregnant. He never needed a nursing break. He had a wife at home to take care of family time. And so to the extent that we organize policies around that kind of masculine model, I'm putting it in figurative quotes because, of course, not all men had access to that either. But as long as we organize policies along that masculine model, we are leaving out women, and we're also leaving out increasing numbers of men who are engaging more in child care and family and elder care. If we look at what women's needs are and what the most effective way to close the wage gap, it really isn't, even though I don't deny that these are important, it's really not getting more women in leadership positions. It's really taking on this low wage issue, and it's taking on the question of America's completely inadequate family leave policies and child care policies, its lack of affordable quality child care that allows people to work when they need to work and that allows people to take time off when they need to take time off. These have historically been seen as women's issues. My argument is that these women's issues are now in the interest of most men.
A woman boss would be no more likely to ignore the imperative of profit maximization than a male boss, would she, just because she's a woman?
Obviously, there are huge class differences among women, and all you have to think of is people like Sarah Palin and Margaret Thatcher and their economic policies, and you recognize that there's nothing magical about being female that gives you more sympathy for your employees, whether they're male or female. On the other hand, there are some very interesting studies. There's one study that shows that when you get a majority, it's not just a woman leader. In fact, a woman leader can be worse, because if you get a woman in a leadership position of a company or a political process that is male-dominated, she may feel that the best way to get ahead is to prove herself as more manly, supposedly, than the men. But it's very interesting when researchers put people together in focus groups, they find that as long as women are a minority or even a full half of a focus group, they tend to defer to the men. They tend to let themselves be interrupted. They tend not to push for policies that have to do with strengthening the social safety net and protecting the vulnerable. But when women begin to be 60 or 80% of a group, they actually are much more likely to push for policies that protect the vulnerable, that think about the social safety net. So there are some gender issues as well as class issues, and they interact in very interesting ways.
You have a funny quote from a Kelly Girl ad back in the old days when they were still called Kelly Girls. The never, never employee never costs you a dime for slack time. When the workload drops, you drop her. This, of course, is the condition of much of the labor force today.
Exactly. And that's my argument. When you look back 50 years ago when women first started saying, we want equal pay, in the long run, of course, feminism has always been in the interests of men. But in the short run, it certainly didn't seem so back in 1964, when if you were a man, and especially if you were a white man, you basically monopolized all the high-paying positions. You could be promoted over women even if you were less competent, because the employer would actually say, well, he has a family to support. She's only working for pin money. So men lost some of that security, or thought they were going to lose some of that security, when women started demanding equal access to it. And they did have to open up unions. They had to get rid of quotas. But men have now, in general, lost that, not because of feminism, but because of this punishing economic climate we've been talking about, because of the reorganization of American business in ways that undercut unionism, that outsource jobs, that then import them back at a much lower level. And all of these things have created, basically, they feminized the workforce. It's not feminists who are emasculating men, as your right wing is always saying, but it's absolutely true that the masculine privileges of white male workers have been steadily eroded, so that, in a sense, you have now never-never boys as well as never-never girls in the workforce.
I'm speaking with Stephanie Kuntz, who teaches history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. I'm wondering if younger men who have grown up in a world with women in school and in workplace beside them, and who don't perhaps have the same sense of patriarchal entitlement that earlier generations of men did, would they be any more receptive to this kind of message?
I think they are. I mean, when you look at the behavior, one other thing that's extremely important, sometimes advocacy groups, feminist, domestic violence or whatever, have this kind of odd idea that you can get more support for your cause by talking about how much you've failed. and they fail to recognize how much progress has been made. Domestic violence has been halved just since 1992, and it's way, way lower than it was in the 60s and 70s. Men are doing triple the child care and twice the housework that they used to do. No, it's not caught up with women yet, and women may complain that they still tend to be put in charge, or maybe it's because we still tend to take charge because we're both still battling those old socialization. But young men's ideas and behaviors are changing very, very rapidly. And yes, I think they are much more sympathetic to these, not just as women's issues, but their own issues. The polls show that more and more young men are thinking of family leave, paternity leave, child care issues as their issues.
I was once denounced when I gave a talk at UC Santa Cruz when I said that feminism should celebrate itself as perhaps the most successful political movement of our time. And a couple of women in the audience thought that was a very improper thing to say. But it's a good idea to celebrate some victories, isn't it?
Exactly. Gosh, who wants to join a movement that just gets, you know, loses every battle? It seems to me that it's very important that we recognize, despite the fact that there is a long, long way to go, that we have made extraordinary, stunning changes in what is historically a very small amount of time.
You have a surprising fact in this piece that the U.S. has a higher proportion of highly skilled and highly paid women workers in the better jobs than social democratic countries like Sweden and Norway. Yet the wage gap is narrower in the Scandinavian countries. What's up with that?
Well, this is one of the contradictions of the market economy. The fact that we have such a free market economy and we have so many low-wage workers allows some women to buy childcare if their wages are high enough, to really devote themselves to working in what was the traditional masculine idea of a, you know, the 24/7 kind of availability to your employer. We have high levels of education for women. And one of the flip side of America's lack of concern for a social safety net is a very strong concern for, acceptance of individual aspiration and ambition. So there are women who really can make a go of it, and more power to them. And they have developed high skills, high leadership, and they're right out there. But the problem is that they are there. They have gotten so high precisely because we have such tremendous inequality. And one of the uncomfortable things, I think, for women in the middle, I think when you get up to the Sheryl Sandberg area, those women actually seem to pay their nannies and childcare people very, very well and to be very considerate of them. What's sad is that the in-between women, the women who are aspiring, probably can't afford to do it. So they end up taking advantage of the availability of low-paid childcare and domestic workers and house cleaners in order to get ahead in our 24/7 economy. So there are all sorts of ways in which this is a problem of class and gender cut sort of clash against each other here.
You said earlier that women in their 20s often make more or equal amounts to what men make until they have a kid, of course, and that's the magic moment where a lot of problematic things kick in. So what can we do about that?
A very large part of that is, again, because of two things. First of all, there's a very personal element to it, and that is that men and women have been socialized to believe that women are better at doing childcare, that women who don't want to stay home with their kids or spend more time with their kids are, in fact, that there's something wrong with them, that men can't do it. So there is a personal choice element here, that women tend to be the ones who, when sacrifices have to be made for a family, they tend to be the ones who make it. But the other side of it is we live in a society that forces many more sacrifices to be made and that has kind of an all-or-nothing approach to it. You know, only half of American workers actually even have access to unpaid leave because so many workers work in companies that have under 50 employees. But even the ones who are eligible for it often don't take it because we are the only major country, wealthy country in the world, that does not offer subsidized parental leave so that it doesn't become a class privilege to stay home with your kid. We also have higher levels of overwork for professionals and lower levels of protection for low-wage workers so that, on the one hand, professionals are often working 50-hour work weeks. Those are much more common, or 50-hour-plus work weeks in America than in other industrial countries. But we also have low-wage workers who have to work a couple of jobs to get by. So the work-family stress is extreme, and there is a tendency then that forces and reinforces the idea that it's women who should be the ones who cut back on their employment. And men can't afford to cut back because there's no option for kind of dividing it up. In Europe, they have a law that you can't pay part-timers a lower wage per hour than you pay full-time workers. But here in the United States, it's often full-time work or poverty level wages, or you can't even cut back because, of course, we still don't have universal health insurance, and you lose your health insurance if you cut back. That makes it very difficult for men and women to share things equally. There are a lot of experiments being done because they find that even with good parental leave, this kind of inherited long-term idea that women are the main childbearers and child carers means that men are less likely to take these leaves. So some countries and counties, like in Quebec recently, have been experimenting with mandatory paternity leave and use it or lose it leave, which has really increased male take-up. And the very encouraging thing about that is that men who take parental leave end up staying much more involved as parents, taking more time off as their children grow because they get used to it, they enjoy it, and also they learn that they can be competent at it when they actually have the responsibility to be.
So child care is typically framed as a woman's issue, but is there a way to make it appeal to men?
Well, I think that it is increasingly appealing to men, and we should see it, child care, as a human right. You know, child care can be, anybody can tell you who does it, sometimes it can be very, very frustrating, but it's one of the most, everybody says, even if it's frustrating, even if it's tiring, even if you're not always happy doing it, it's one of the most meaningful activities that parents, male and female, report engaging in their lives. So if we can show that to people, then we should have men clamoring for the right to engage in it, and growing numbers of young men are.
And finally, the whole issue of the low wage, the size of the low wage labor force in the U.S., you know, again, that used to be seen as predominantly a female issue because women have a lot of very low wage retail occupations. But to what degree is this broad structure of the U.S. labor force with a very large and very permanent low wage sector, how gendered is that issue or how ungendered could it be?
Well, it's still fairly gendered. Three-quarters of low-wage workers are female. But when you actually look at the what some economists have called the hollowing out of the American occupational structure, you're finding that men are falling down more and more into low-wage or just barely above low-wage, barely above poverty level wages that really should count as low wage. And I used a statistic that really surprised me in my op-ed, and that is that as men and women have moved out of middle skill occupations in this hollowing out process, only 1% of the loss of middle school jobs for women has been a result of women moving into low skill jobs. Most of it has been them moving up because, of course, of the feminist movement and the gains we've made. But of the men who've lost their access to middle school, to middle skill jobs, half of them have moved down. So, again, this is something where you're getting a gender-neutral de-skilling of the American workforce, which means that we do need, eventually, a gender-neutral movement to improve workers' wages. But right now, what we have to do is break the idea that the only way to improve wage labor is what we've traditionally thought of as the masculine way of, you know, like leveling the playing field so that everybody can individually go on and move their way up. And we tell men, get a college education. Well, actually, improving low-wage jobs and low-skill jobs pay would be in the interest of most men because of the fastest growing jobs in America, most of them do not require a college degree and are very low wage jobs. So, you know, just this idea that you're going to do it with this masculine, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get yourself an education and compete, this is an old model that doesn't work.
As Stephanie Kuntz, author most recently of A Strange Stirring, a book about the effects of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique on a Generation of Women and Men. Kuntz teaches history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Washington. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. ¶¶ Some of the third movement of Haydn's String Quartet No. 11, performed by the Kodály Quartet. Next up, Branko Milanović. Milanović is an economist who spent many years at the World Bank, where he led a project to get a true picture of the world's income distribution. He has a paper, co-written with Christoph Lackner, that was posted in December to the World Bank's website, that looks at the world's income distribution from the fall of the Berlin Wall to the Great Recession. He recently left the bank and is now a presidential fellow at the City University of New York. Branko Milanović. Let's start by talking about the ways that people have in the past estimated inequality or equality on a global scale. The simplest is just comparing country per capita incomes. First of all, what does that tell us over the last couple of decades, and what are the shortcomings of that approach?
Well, first, Doug, thank you very much for having me on your show. Let me try to answer this question as quickly and simply as I can. In the past, of course, people were essentially comparing incomes, GDP per capita, which is basically mean income of a country, with each other, and for, 100 countries in the world. And essentially, the gaps have been increasing since the Industrial Revolution, if you take the top and the bottom, because obviously, with the time in the 1920s or 1950s, the gap between the richest and the poorest country was about 3 to 4 to 1. Well, the gap, of course, now it's more than 100 to 1. So the gaps, measured in such simplistic way, have been rising. However, what is really much more important and interesting is what is inequality between individuals, because after all, countries are very different by size. You have China and you have Luxembourg, so you obviously would like to actually study global inequality, between inequality between individuals. Now, the problem there was that we didn't have data to do that, because in order to do that, you have to have household surveys which get incomes or consumption of individuals around the world. And for many countries in the world, there was no data for that. So it is only in the mid to late 1980s that we eventually were able to put together for more than 100 countries such information.
Just before we go any further, the per capita GDP doesn't really very accurately represent what's going on with household incomes in a lot of countries, does it?
Well, of course, that's one reason, actually. The GDP does not represent what really is consumption or income at a household level, because you have, of course, large chunk of GDP, which is corporate income. For example, retained profits or corporate profits are not part of consumption. So if you take that profits and give them to sort of, quote unquote, give them to some people in an accounting sense, you're, of course, overestimating their purchasing power or their income. On top of that, obviously, GDP is an aggregate average measure. And what we really want to have, we want to have actual incomes of poor people, middle-class people, and rich people in each country.
Okay, now to the household survey question. A lot of countries do these household surveys, and one of the things you've been doing over the last couple of decades is trying to massage them together into some kind of comparability, right?
That's right. Actually, it does seem sort of like technical issue and people are bored when you speak of household surveys, but it's absolutely crucial. For example, because the point is the following. You want to know what are the incomes of people, of course, around the world, but to do that, you start with household surveys in each individual country. And without that, you absolutely have no means of ascertaining that, short of possibly using fiscal data, but fiscal data about direct taxes are really available only for rich countries. For, middle-income and poor countries, relatively few people pay direct taxes, so basically you just get on top of the income distribution, not anybody else. So once you have the household survey data, then of course you try to actually make them as similar or as comparable as possible. Comparable meaning that the definitions of income or consumption should be the same. And the second thing that you need to do is to introduce an adjustment for the price level. Obviously, India has a price level which is much lower than Norway. So you have to actually boost incomes in India compared to what they would be if you just simply take the exchange rate, to show that actually welfare in India is higher than if you simply take, you know, and express it in ordinary dollar terms. Because, you know, for example, food in India costs less than in Norway or the U.S. So that's the second big adjustment that you have to do. And for that, we rely on a huge project, which is called International Comparison Project, which compares price levels across the world.
Which is sounds easy in principle, but is not in practice.
Well, it's not at all easy. Actually, you really work with two huge chunks of data. One are all these household surveys that I already mentioned, which come from like 100, 120 countries in the world, which need to be standardized. And the second chunk is a totally separate exercise that is been going on first with OECD countries and then since 1980s with the entire world, whose objective is really to sort of get individual items and get their prices all around the world and then compare the price levels. And it's really, it's an enormous exercise because you have like about 1,000 commodities that you have to price out in, you know, China, Nigeria, Indonesia, Japan, U.S., elsewhere. And of course, it depends like where do you price them out, cities, villages, and so on. So it's a huge exercise.
Dispensing with all these problems. When you started doing this work back in, well, I think your data begins around 1988, how many countries in the world did reliable household surveys?
Well, you know, the number of countries has not expanded that much. The big change happened in the mid-80s for several reasons. First, the Soviet data, which in the past existed because they were in collecting household surveys, they were not available. So basically, you had a large part of the world which was not covered there. Secondly, the Chinese data really start actually kicking in only after the end of the Cultural Revolution and some normalization in China, that was 1982. And third, data for Africa were not really available with the exception of a few countries like South Africa and a couple of others until mid-1980s. So in the mid-1980s, there was really a big change for all these three, in all these three regions. And after that, I don't think that we have really increased the coverage a lot. So we're really talking about 120 countries with approximately 90 to 92% of the world population. I want to mention here that actually the countries that we don't have the data for are generally very poor countries which are in conflict, in civil wars, and so on. So whatever we do, essentially, is a lower bound on inequality because lots of countries like, you know, South Sudan, the Central African Republic, Sierra Leone, Afghanistan, we don't really have the data for.
Okay, so let's now do some historical generalizations. I think a lot of people would instinctively assume that the global distribution of income has gotten more unequal over the last 20 or 30 years. How does that comport with what you found?
Well, that's not exactly true. First, the global inequality is extremely high, and it's actually higher than inequality even in the most unequal country like South Africa. To give the order of magnitude, we use the Gini coefficient, which ranges from zero when everybody has the same income, doesn't happen anywhere, to 100, which is the maximum value which entire income would be taken by one person. Well, normal incomes in OECD countries are actually distributed with the Gini of 35. South Africa has a Gini of 60, and the world has a Gini of 70. So just to give you an idea that the world is extremely unequal place. But it has actually, inequality in the world has not increased or has even possibly declined a little bit because of the large increase in incomes in China and India, which are, of course, poor countries and getting a little bit less poor or you know, a little bit wealthier now, and which actually drive global inequality down. So I really liken them to the two sumo wrestlers who are actually fighting global inequality because they are actually the only force, but the important force, in the last 20 years that fought against global inequality. Because on the other hand, inequality in each individual country went up. So you have these two forces offsetting each other. The increase of inequalities in each individual country, including China, and on the other hand, the growth of Chinese quote-unquote middle class.
Okay, let's talk about China. I think another popular perception is that it's a country filled with exploited sweatshop labor, where people make pennies an hour. What has happened with Chinese incomes over the last 20 years?
Well, what happened with Chinese incomes is, I mean, in a nutshell, is two developments. One, China has had the highest sustained growth rate for largest amount of people ever by far ever registered in the world. So it has been actually a transformation that has never been seen before. And by the order of magnitude compared to UK, compared to Japan and the United States. And of course, compared to anybody else in the world. So that's the good news. The bad news, of course, that China inequality has expanded tremendously. So inequality not only between, of course, individuals that we, has now sort of overtaken the U.S. in the level of inequality, but also in any other aspect, which is actually striking. So you look at the average gap between urban and rural areas that has expanded, and it's probably now the largest in the world. You look at the gap between the provinces, maritime provinces that are actually doing very well, and the western regions of China that are actually doing sort of much less well. So that gap has increased as well. So basically, whichever way you slice the cake in China, you have an increased inequality.
But now, leaving apart the relative distribution of incomes, what's happened to the broad spectrum of incomes in China? Has everyone gained, just some more than others?
Yeah, that's basically what has happened. You know, it's. I also forgot to mention that another way that you look at the distribution is between capital and labor. That has also moved in favor of capital in China as well. So what has happened is essentially at every point of the income distribution in China, you have had real gains. The thing is actually that the real gains have been increasing the higher you go into the income distribution. So the real gains, for example, for the top 1% over the last 20 years have increased their real income by a factor of 3.5. If you look at the median, the real increase is a factor 2.5. If you look at the bottom, the real increase is doubling.
And then what's happened to rural incomes?
Well, rural incomes have increased as well in real terms. But at every point of the distribution, again, the rural incomes have increased less than urban incomes. And within rural areas as well, you have the same movement that actually the higher you stand up in the income distribution in rural areas, the larger is your gain. So again, the same very, very sort of consistent pattern in China is everybody gains in real terms, but if you're rich, you gain more.
Wall Street people like to talk about Chindia as if China and India were one country, but how does Indian experience compare with what you just described in China?
Well, Indian experience is somewhat less clear because the transformation has not been as rapid and as extraordinary as China. You know, both China and the U.S. share one feature which makes it very interesting to study them, not only because they're the two most important countries, but also because the changes in income distribution have been very sharp in both countries. So you have really no doubt what has happened. India is a more difficult case because in India we have noticed an increase in inequality. There is clearly an increase and even rising urban to rural gap, similar to China, but it's more muted. Now, the problem also, I have to mention that as well, is that India uses consumption data, which generally tend to sort of show less dramatic changes than income data. So there are some arguments recently being put together with the data showing that actually inequality in India is significantly higher when you measure it by incomes than when you measure it by the consumption of people, and that India may be at the same level of inequality like China.
And speaking of the economist Branko Balanović, who spent many years at the World Bank and is now a presidential fellow at the City University of New York Graduate Center. What you just said brings us to an interesting theoretical parenthesis. What is the proper thing that should be measured? People usually measure income. Some countries, some surveys measure consumption. A lot of political conservatives who don't want to talk too much about income inequality like to emphasize consumption measures. What are the relative merits of measuring by consumption versus income?
Well, you see, that also seems on the face of it like a sort of a methodological issue, and it is, but it's also a political issue. I'm actually very much in favor of having a worldwide income distribution survey. So that's feasible. We have the Gallup, which has actually started doing something similar already. Unfortunately, UN and the World Bank should be at the forefront of that, but they are not yet. Now, why do you prefer income? I think income is better because it really reflects your ability first to purchase goods and services and to have power over other people, labor, or even to have a political power. It's really income which represents that unit, which measures your welfare and your power. Now, it is true that actually some people argue in favor of consumption because consumption gives you a sort of more direct estimate of how people sort of how much they consume and how well or badly they live on a day-to-day basis or actually annual basis. But if you just simply imagine two persons having the same consumption, exactly the same consumption, but one having an income which is three times as large, obviously the person who has a much larger income has first a potential to save, has a potential to live better in the future, and also has much more, you know, power, whichever way you want to define power, than the person who is actually who has one-third of his income.
Back to the global distribution, this extraordinary growth in China, and to a lesser extent India, what has this done to the global income distribution?
Well, what it has done for the global, it has really been an equalizing force. As I said before, it's like, as I said, two sumo wrestlers who through their growth are basically fighting an increase in global inequality. Had not China and India grown so fast, we would have definitely had an increase in global inequality because all the other forces were in favor of increased inequality. Because when you add up increases in inequality in practically all nations in the world and also rising gaps between, let's suppose, you know, rich nations and Africa, then you have really two very potent forces that push global inequality up. The only force of significance that is countervailing that is growth rates of poor countries, and in particular poor and populous countries like China and India.
And what has been happening in Latin America?
Well, Latin America is a very interesting case because it is the region that historically had the highest inequality. So practically everybody in Latin America is a high inequality country. Now, this is still true, because all of the countries in Latin America, I think with the exception of maybe Venezuela, are more unequal than the U.S. still. But what was interesting in Latin America, and in particular in Brazil, is that they have gone through a decline in inequality, modest but, you know, significant, over the last 20 years, where the entire rest of the world has actually seen within each individual country an increase in inequality. So that's why, you know, Latin America is a very interesting case because it shows that you can actually curb the increase in inequality.
And then what about the Soviet Union or former Soviet Union and its former satellites in Eastern Europe?
Well, there everybody has had a significant increase in inequality. There are, of course, variants of that. But if you look, for example, if you look at the Central European countries that have joined the European Union, they have had very small increase and they are still sort of below the OECD average. Actually, countries like Czech Republic, Slovenia, Slovakia, which are very small countries indeed, but they're the countries, Hungary as well, with some of the lowest levels of inequality in the world, although it is higher than it was 20 years ago. And then, of course, the more you move towards east, and if you go into, obviously, Russia, but also other oil-producing countries like Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan and so on, then, of course, the increase in inequality are staggering. So they have had a huge increase in inequality.
And what about their average incomes relative to the world?
Well, the average incomes, you know, it again depends, actually, because different countries have done differently. But it was not, by any stretch of imagination, it was not a good period, these 20 years, for the post-communist countries. It's essentially that they have, in the best cases, of course, the best case of all of them is Poland, which has had a fairly good experience. But in practically all other cases, they have been able just to maintain, at best, their position in the world, relative position in the world, in many cases to decline. Actually, even Russia, despite the oil boom and everything else, has declined in terms of its relative incomes if you compare it to the rest of the world.
And Africa?
Africa has had a very bad period from 1980s to practically 2000. It has been really a disaster in the sense that incomes have at best stagnated in many countries. They have declined. I remember some years ago, I looked at the number of countries that had GDP per capita, which is less than in 1960. And there were, I think, 15 countries in Africa that were poorer than they were at the time of independence. Then it has changed in the 2000s because they started growing relatively fast, whether it is on the back of the demand for raw materials without any fundamental change, it's quite possible. But the situation has improved, and Africa is now definitely better off than it was 10 years ago.
And now, finally, you have several graphs in your paper on the growth of income at various percentiles of the global distribution, and that makes for a very interesting story. Let's start from the bottom. People at the very bottom of the income distribution, the bottom 5% or so of the world income distribution, have done quite poorly.
Yes, what has actually happened there is that at the bottom, we of course cannot really have a very precise estimate there because these incomes are so tiny. I mean, people don't realize it. This is really, we're talking about people who have incomes of about like $300 or $400 per year. So whether it goes up by $3 or $4, it's oftentimes very difficult to figure out exactly. But there is clearly the fact that actually their incomes have not grown significantly. But then when you start going up the income distribution, then you have, of course, large increases, and the largest increases happen around the middle of the global income distribution, which means there are still people who are very poor by U.S. standards, but they are actually sort of what I call the global median class. These are people who in China would be around the middle of the income distribution. So they have gained quite a lot.
Yeah, it was striking that people from, say, the 10th percentile up to about the 70th have all seen substantial income gains over the last couple of decades.
That's true. And actually, the largest gains have happened around the median, which means that the mid position of the global income distribution, where you had something like a doubling, on average, doubling of the incomes. Of course, some of them, as I mentioned China before, they actually had more than a doubling. Some others had less. But that's where the major gains have been registered. Although one has to be careful, we are talking here about relative gains, which means percentage gain of those people. But when you look at the absolute amounts of money that they have gained, they are very small. I mean, if you compare them with, sort of Western metric, because simply these people are still very, very poor by, again, Western standards. These are people whose incomes, even after the increase, are below the incomes of what would be like people who will be on social welfare, in the United States.
Yeah, when we're talking about the median of the global income distribution, what kind of income and countries are we talking about?
Well, we are mostly talking there, like 90% of people there around the median are people from Asia. So the usual countries that, China, India, Indonesia, Thailand, and so on. But their incomes, the incomes of people around that median, are about between $4 and $5 per day in these international prices. And that is about half of maybe even one-third, in some cases, of the social minimum or the, eligibility for welfare benefits in the United States. So this is actually people who are very poor by the Western standards.
Some of the people who have done worst over the last couple of decades are people who certainly get a lot of attention, which would be the lower portion of the income distribution in the richer countries.
Yes, that's actually the most interesting part of that graph, and I think also probably of our paper, is that the gains have been almost quasi-nil or very small among the people who are in the global income distribution relatively high, around the 70th or actually 80th percentile, but who in their own countries, like the United States, are the bottom portion of U.S. income distribution. So they are really, there are very small gains. In the U.S., it was less than 20% for them. In Germany, it was 7% in real terms. In Japan, it was negative 1%. So these are the people, and other, West European countries where the gains were similarly small, these are the people who really saw very little in terms of real gain over the last 20 years.
Which presents a political problem because, we certainly feel for people who are at the lower half of the income distribution in their countries, but by global standards, they're quite rich. So how do we think about this?
Well, you put your finger on this is the key issue, because if you look at them simply, if you, for example, abstract from nationality and just look at the world as a whole, certainly the fact that poorer people have benefited significantly is a good news. It's, by any welfare standard, it is a good news. However, the world is composed of nation states, and the nation states have their own government, and the governments, in principle, are worried or care about income distribution. So then you have a political problem that in quite a few rich countries, people who were at the bottom portion of their national income distributions have not gained, and actually to some extent may associate their absence of gain to the growth of China and China's and India's of this world. So that really presents really a political issue for the countries, for the rich countries.
And in conclusion, we have to mention the proverbial 1%. The top global 1% has been doing rather well.
Yes, that's absolutely true. So we basically have a story there that of large gains around the median, absence of the gains among the relatively poor people in rich countries, and then finally for the global top 1%, whether it is in individual countries or in the world, we have considerable real gains. So that's how this peculiar shape has been formed, is that actually the main winners of the 20 or 25 years of globalization have been really the global top 1% and national top 1%, and also people who are relatively poor, like people working under, as you called it before, sweatshops in China and India and Thailand and elsewhere. And the major relative losers have been relatively poor people in rich countries.
That's Branko Milanović. Milanović spent many years at the World Bank and is now at the City University of New York Graduate Center. The political point that comes up at the end, how to think about the fact that while the middle two-thirds of the global income distribution has done reasonably well over the last couple of decades, the less well-off and rich countries like the U.S. have not, is a challenge. Maybe one way to approach the problem is to make income from work less important to material well-being and to strive instead for more quality, security, and happiness. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, apropos of nothing but that it is a great song, some of Nona Hendrix and Material doing Bustin' Out from 1981. Till next week, bye.